welcome to episode 90 of the Planning Period Podcast, your Ed Break Room. I'm your host, Brad Schreffler. Before I get to this week's episode, I want to remind you about the meetup happening on June 23rd in Philadelphia. We will meet at 6 p.m. at Pat's King of Steaks. It's got me, Chris Nessie, Stacey Lindis, AJ Bianco. I heard Casey Bell and maybe Matt Miller are going to be there. Just some awesome podcasters are going to be making appearances at this live meetup. So again, that's June 23rd, 6 p.m. at Pat's King of Steaks in Philadelphia. So if you're going to be out at ISTE, make sure you meet up with us there, and we'll go grab Philly cheesesteaks in one place, then go over to Gino's, grab another steak, compare the two, and maybe find something to do after that as well in the area. So June 23rd, 6 p.m., Pat's King of Steaks. Come there, rep the Planning Period Podcast, come say hi to me, talk to some other education podcasters, and have a good time. This week on the show, I am joined by Glenn Irvin. Glenn is a former Spanish teacher, now instructional coach, and one of the hosts of the On Education podcast, which is not just an awesome show, but just blowing up the education space right now. I also had the chance to meet Glenn last year at ISTE briefly, and he was a really cool guy to chat with, so I knew he was going to be an awesome guest, and I was really excited to get him to join me on the show. Glenn and I talk about his podcast and how it came to be, what being an instructional technology coach is like, the challenges and advantages of being an instructional coach, the problems with standardized testing, the need to step out of your classroom and use social media to connect with other educators, Glenn's thoughts on teachers pay teachers and other side hustles, and the importance of telling kids they are special. So, sit back and enjoy episode 90 of the Planning Period Podcast, my interview with Glenn Irvin. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Planning Period Podcast. I am your host, as always, Brad Schreffler. And, I'm just going to jump right into it because my guest and I have already been having a good time chatting before I hit record. So I am joined today by the one and only Glenn Irvin, one of the hosts of the On Education Podcast, which is just blowing up the education podcast scene. And so, Glenn, thanks for joining me, man.
Thanks for having me, Brad. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you on. You know, we've tried to schedule it for a little bit and finally lined it out, so it's worked out well. I'm excited.
Absolutely.
And we've been chatting, as my friend Chris Clough and Roland Chidiak would call, the on-ramp leading up to the start of hitting record. We were already joking and laughing and had a good time, so I'm confident that this is going to be a great episode of the show.
That's always the best way to begin. when everybody's in a good mood at the beginning of the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. So for my audience who don't know you, could you just do a quick intro to who you are and what you're about?
Absolutely. So Glenn Irvin, and now I actually go by Glenn Irvin Flores. And I am a former Spanish teacher. I taught Spanish for around 20 years. And then just recently, so for the past year and a half, I've had the opportunity to work as an instructional coach, tech integrationist, and I am located in Sauk Rapids, Minnesota, which is a central-ish Minnesota, and I've lived actually in Minnesota now for the past 15 years, but originally I'm from the Southwest. I'm from El Paso, Texas. but now I guess, Minnesota really is our home. So I think we're going to claim it and we're going to stay here.
Awesome. And of course, co-host of the On Education Pod, which,
absolutely,
I mean, just such good stuff. I was saying right before we recorded, we met at ISTE last year and,
yes,
knew about the podcast. And as my audience knows, I listen to 9 hours a week of podcasts as it is.
Wow.
So picking up an extra has always been hard. And I finally picked yours up and I'm annoyed that I waited so long because it has quickly, it's not in the play last on the queue anymore. It's the, when it's downloaded, put it at the top because it needs to be next so that I'm up to date. Like, it's there's very few shows that get a jump to top row, and you guys got it. I love you and Mike, the way you guys play off each other and have really interesting conversations, but while clearly just two friends chatting about it. I love the feel of your show.
Oh, really appreciate that. And it's an interesting dynamic, especially because it was by happenstance that we happened to basically meet, because we didn't know each other in real life. We knew each other in Twitter world, which is funny. And then how we actually ended up getting together is just crazy.
You mentioned this on one of your episodes recently, but do you mind just telling the short version of the story of how the podcast came about?
Sure. Mike actually, he's what I want to call the dreamer type, but the dreamer type that makes... that like hammers his dreams to reality, I guess is the best way to be able to describe him. And he already had the podcast thought in his mind. And he actually came up to me at a conference in Chicago. It was Schoology Next conference. And I didn't actually even know Mike at all. And he came up to me and introduced himself. And we were following each other on Twitter, but I honestly had no idea who he was or anything about him. And we talked about video games for a little bit. And then he said, hey, we should start a podcast. And I didn't listen to podcasts at all. So I was like, a what? And he's like, a podcast. And I'm like, oh, yeah, yeah. And I completely ignored him. And he actually then approached me after the conference a couple of different times and kind of laid it out kind of how it would work and what it was about. And he already had kind of what the segments of the podcast would be and some ideas about what shows, how, you know, what types of shows we would have. It was kind of like laid out and I was like, well, let's go ahead and venture and do this. And funny enough, you know, the first times we actually spoke and we were just practicing, just speaking to each other, was the most awkward thing ever. Just because we really didn't know each other. We're kind of trying to have these conversations on different topics, really don't know where each other stands because you're trying to fill each other out, kind of like the first date kind of thing.
Yep.
So I'm sure it was really, really awkward. We actually recorded a demo episode, I want to call it, a beta episode, and gave it to our friends and our families to, you know, give us some feedback on them. And I'm sure that demo episode is really horrible.
Is that, that's the infamous episode zero?
Yes, episode zero is horrible. But it's perfect because then now we know how far we've come. And of course, we're really comfortable with each other now. We talk constantly, you know, through text messages, phone calls, and whatever it might be. So, yeah, it's kind of like I have another brother. I have a younger brother, but I also have Mike. He's my other brother.
Yeah. It's funny. I have I don't even know that I've ever admitted this on the show, but I have an episode zero. There's an episode out there that will never see the light of day because it's so incredibly bad. And with a guest show, it was a friend of mine that I had do it. And maybe about 6 months into the podcast, they were like, are you ever going to release the episode we did? And I go, no, that was terrible. They go, well, I wasn't that bad. I go, oh no, you were fine. I was terrible. That just never needs to see the light of day. I didn't have a clue what I was doing yet. So, but no, I can relate with that a lot. I just think it's cool that you guys can just meet up and then be like, hey, let's start a podcast. And you go, sure, I guess.
I know. And there is some kind of weird, chemistry. That's what I tell Mike all the time, is that a lot of the feedback that we get from people everywhere, people that we know and obviously people that we don't even know, the biggest feedback we get is something similar to what you just finished phrasing there, which is they enjoy really the first segment of the show the best, which is just us kind of just talking, you know, and kind of laughing back and forth and, you know, making fun of each other and whatever else that we're doing there. So that's really cool because I think that people, especially in our profession, sometimes need a break from all of the heavy stuff. And so this is I'm glad that we could play a part in kind of the funny parts, you know, and then bring in the serious topics, of course.
Yeah. Well, I think I agree. The beginning section is really cool, but I think my new front runner is now the dig it or ditch it segment, which has become a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that a couple times with you guys kind of going back and forth and figuring it out. It's been kind of cool.
Yeah. So yeah, Dig It or Ditch It is Noah Geisel. And I met him at a conference also. And he gave me the opportunity to be a keynote speaker at what's called CCFLT. It's a foreign language teachers conference in Colorado. And he has such a good vibe and we got along so well with him at a couple of different conferences. We were like, we have to bring you on. And then he came up with that pitch for us. We're like, what do you guys think about this? And I won't tell you what I'm going to, you know, we'll just do it by surprise as far as on the podcast. So it'll be funnier. And so that's become a super fun segment, which we're going to actually do this next week. It's going to be our May episode, which will be super fun. We always look forward to that.
Yeah, that's cool. I've enjoyed the last couple ones. They've been fun. So, well, you know, it really is a fun show. I really enjoy it. And but I want to also talk about you specifically. You know, you said a year and a half as a digital coach,
yes,
as an instructional technology coach. What has that been like for you? This is a weak question, but have you enjoyed that role?
It's actually a really good question because I've been doing a lot of introspection. This is, the first year was just kind of a blur because I came in, I actually left a school in November. Can you imagine doing that? After having worked there for 13 years. And then I took this job in a completely different town, 160 miles away. And so it was a complete transplant myself. So the year went by in a blur. So from November to May last year, it was exciting because it was all new. Now it's been a year, and I've definitely done some introspection and trying to, it's way different than being a teacher. That's the best way I can describe it. And in the way that it's different is that a lot of times when I was teaching, you feel like you're a hero, like you've made a difference. You can tell things actually happen in your class, both highs and lows, and you get to feel those things. And in digital, as a digital coach, you have to take a step back. So it's kind of like being a coach of a sport where you're either the athlete, but the coach kind of sits back, you know, same thing as a digital coach or instructional coach, where you're helping to put teachers into the right positions, whether it be with technology or just instructional, pedagogy or whatever it might be. And you have to take a step back, which is really hard for me as far as, you know, my personality, but it's been an adjustment. But, you know, I've really enjoyed it. And I have a really amazing staff that I work with, other instructional coaches that are amazing. And then also the teachers also at the school that are awesome.
So I'm an instructional technology coach as well, yeah. And I'm in my fourth or fifth year doing it now, but my first year at a new school. So when you talk about that first year being a blur,
yes,
100% agree. That first year as technology coach, it was also the first year of a one-to-one program, which is why they brought me into that role. And so that first year, I felt like I literally put on running shoes and never took them off.
Absolutely.
It was just run from room to room. I didn't have time to walk. I didn't have time to think. It was running from place to place. And so it's amazing the tricks you learn to make your day more manageable. And then by making your day more manageable, you're able to have better impact on teachers and students. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I totally agree. And I was going to ask you, year four, how does it feel then? You know, kind of from, you know, stepping away from, you know, a classroom setting into year four, I actually want some guidance and instruction from people that have been there. Kind of like, what does that feel like at the end of that tunnel, you know, for you?
It's been weird. So at my last school, I used to joke that I very intentionally worked myself out of a job.
Yeah.
Because I think the role of an instructional technology coach is a temporary position.
Absolutely.
And the reason I say that is because, especially in my case, I was designated to roll out a one-to-one initiative.
Yes.
So
specific task.
Once you've done that, you should get to a point where digital instruction is not a word you use anymore. It's just instruction.
Instruction, yes.
And so your role changes. And so my role at that school evolved very much over my 3 years from being technology instruction to an instructional coach who did everything.
Yes.
You know, I ran all of the PD and managed all of that, not just technology. And it was just that technology was how we instructed at that school. It was no longer an extra thing. It was just what we did.
Yes.
And so switching schools now, it's year four and all the things and tips and tricks I figured out to manage my own life over 3 years, but still with a flair of that year one chaos, because
yes,
it's still it's the first year for this school,
oh, yeah,
in a one-to-one initiative.
I get you.
And so it's like, I get to take everything I learned and do it better this time. And so it's been a combination of running from place to place, but with a little more wisdom and how to do those things effectively. So it's been a very interesting year. Exhausting, don't get me wrong.
I bet.
Totally exhausting.
I bet.
But it's been interesting.
Absolutely. No, I could see that where you already had the experience, and then now you come back into year one, which is always that really energetic, high energy year where everybody's, you know, you're moving at 100 miles per hour to try to get everything, put into the school, which is just an awesome time too.
Yeah, it is. It simultaneously can be frustrating, which is really my own fault for the most part, because I do work with a wonderful staff. But for me, I keep thinking, guys, we've been doing this for years. Oh, wait, no, you haven't. Just I have. Don't just get annoyed. That's a genuine. Just kidding. My bad. You don't know that. Never mind. That's obvious, but not to you. That's cool. That's fine.
Yeah, you want to push.
So you have to remind yourself. So it is fun, though. I think coaching is a role that never gets easy, but I think it gets easier the longer you do it. I think as you get used to the role and figure out those ways to manage your life and be productive in the chaos that is outside the classroom, I think that it gets easier, but I don't think it ever gets
easy. That's really, really good advice. And, I'm going to have some time this summer to go out and reflect and then kind of come back at it. And now in my true year two, to be able to kind of say, okay, what are the things that I really want to make sure, how do I want to make an impact and make the most I can as far as the biggest impact I can, with the staff that we have.
Yeah. I will say, and I think I've talked about it on the show before, but the thing that has saved my life in terms of managing my time is developing an appointment calendar with time slots so the teachers can fill out their own times and pick when they need me to come to them. That has been everything for
me.
That's
a really good idea.
And I developed it in Google Calendar, and because there's the appointment slots built into a G Suite for education account. And I used that, and then I built a back-end program using Google Sheets that automates surveys to everyone that books me. So at the end of the day, if they had an appointment with me, it sends them a quick email and says, hey, please take a minute to fill out this survey, which is just a Google form. And then I'm able to track the results and say, okay, I was late to this one. I was on time here. This person thought I was helpful. This one needs follow-up on that. And now those surveys are a way for me to track not only what I've done and kind of justify my pay, but also, am I being effective? Who am I able to help? And then when people say, well, I didn't know I needed to do that. You weren't there to support me. And I say, oh, so you used my appointment calendar to book me? well, no, I didn't do that.
I really love that, Brad. I mean, awesome that I'm on the podcast here with you, but really want to make sure I connect with you outside of this too, because I think a lot of us as instructional coaches try to find what is the best way, basically like you just said, to manage our time effectively, but also to make the most impact with our teachers and also to make our teachers feel like we will be there for them, so they can just, like you just said, they can calendar us in, boom, make the schedule appointment, and we can go in and be there for them. It's a fantastic idea. I love it.
It's saved my life. When I started doing it my second year, like you said, the lessons you learn, right? That first year I said, I couldn't manage my time. I felt like I was a chicken with my head cut off all the time. How can I fix it? And it was at ISTE, someone talked about using appointment slots. And in my head, it was like, okay, that's a good idea, but I can build on it and add this and I can add this and I can, oh, now this is a solution that's going to work for me.
I love it, man. Yes, for sure. So, I will be following up with that.
Yeah, I think I have a blog post about how I did it too. I mean, remind me, I'll send that to you. So I'm loving this. We're just like, this is so much fun. I'm having a good time already. I love it. I feel like I'm just like sitting in on an episode of your podcast, just chatting, just having a good time.
That's good.
It's good. All right. So, but I do want to frame our discussion a little bit, and I know I want to get to my normal question. So without any kind of reasonable transition and just steamrolling straight through, my first question for all my guests is, what is the biggest problem facing education today?
Ooh, man. Well, I was really hot on this topic today, so I might as well just lay it out here as far as what I believe is the biggest problem. The biggest problem, I think, is standardized testing. Just today, we had to facilitate yet another test for our students, and it just made me think. It just got me hot, really quickly as far as to start a Monday off, because I just feel that there's just so many better ways for all of us to be spending our time. I'm talking about everybody from our teachers, paraprofessionals, our administrators, and of course us as instructional coaches and everybody in between, and our students, actually. What am I even talking about? Especially our students can definitely just find more compelling, better ways to be able to connect with their passions versus this over-testing that ends up happening at our schools. And then the purpose for which is kind of this I think it's just been a total political move that now we just are okay with in education, and we sit with it really well, we shouldn't be. We shouldn't be just like okay with it and be like, okay, this is the standard, this is the norm, and it's okay. We need to adjust our schedules to fit all of these tests, and it just makes me feel gross inside. I have a little, I call him little, he's already in sixth grade, a sixth grader, and they spent, you know, 2 weeks of their year and in different forms of testing, and that's, I just think, such a waste of time. Plus it ends up, you know, those students that were already on the edge, you know, it pushes them, I believe, over the edge of saying, school is not the place for me, you know, because they can't find that connection there. And all they feel as far as these standardized tests is a place where they're going to fail because of the high stakes nature of them, because of the, you know, the irrelevance to what they're actually learning, because of their possible discrimination against, you know, their specific race, their specific whatever type of situation that they're in. And so it just feels like the biggest looming thing that looms over all of our shoulders, and that all of us just kind of comply with. It feels very much that we're in a compliance type of state. And I'm hoping that sometime, I actually told a teacher this the other day when they said, how is my year going? And they said, except for the testing, because they laughed about that, you know, because we have to, we do a lot of the delivery of the test, the administration of the testing. I said, you know, I'm hoping that sometime in my life, we will get past this point, that this won't be the norm, that we will be past this, and we'll look back at this point and go, why were we doing that? And then they'll be moving forward with something amazing, creative, and that lets kids really be show their outlets for their passions. And school becomes a place where people, all kids, want to go to, versus, you know, right now where we have some kids that want to come to school. So that's my big spiel. Sorry, rant.
It is particularly pertinent to me right now, given that you know, we're on week 4 or 5 of standardized testing at this point.
Yes.
And it's been at least 2 days a week for the last month and a half. And I am direct, as you said, you know, coaches and anyone in leadership, like, it's directly involved in that testing process. It's, yes, handing out materials. It's checking them back in at the end of the day. It's handling logistics. It's everything else. And like I've also said, one-to-one program, you know, this week is our last full week of school in our area. And I should be collecting 2,700 laptops between now and next Wednesday, which is the last day of school.
Yes.
Which, you know, 2,700 is a lot of laptops.
Oh my goodness.
And it's not so simple as just, okay, hand them to me and I'll just scan them in. You know, you have to make sure they're not damaged, and it's a process. And I spent a solid 2 days building out a plan that would allow me to have a reasonable amount of time to do that. And because of testing problems today with technology, I now have to completely rebuild a plan, because I can't start tomorrow like I was supposed to, because we had to push one of the tests that was supposed to be today onto Wednesday, and now everything is messed up. And so, not only, you know, you started to mention the purpose of this, it feels very political, because we can't use the data from the test to actually inform instruction, because we don't get the results till after the school year is over.
It's gross.
We don't have useful information from it. We don't see the test in advance or after the fact to determine what the kids did or didn't understand. And disrupts so much. And for so many students, I think one of the things we don't talk about enough for testing is, for so many students, the routine of school is often the only routine of their life.
Absolutely.
And when you're testing 10, 15, 20 days in April and May, or May and June, wherever your school gets out, you've completely disrupted the only routine these kids know. They don't know what class they're going to when they get to school every morning. They don't know which periods they're going to see, which teachers they're going to see. And then on top of completely disrupting everything they know to be normal, we're now expecting them to think clearly and represent their learning through a series of multiple choice questions, which is then used to determine if our teachers should be paid a reasonable salary or not. None of this makes any sense.
It makes absolutely no sense. And it just feels, I mean, at the end of the school year, I think it adds to that feeling where teachers at the end of the year, you know, that whole concept of teacher burnout, or the end of the year where teachers are ready to, you know, pull their hair out, like if I had any hair, but we're ready to go ahead and do that kind of stuff. And I think that this is one of the things that puts people, our educators, over the edge. And it definitely, I can see it on the faces of our students, that it is not anything that's good. And you're right. If we actually could use the data to inform instruction and then be able to go ahead and do something about it with our students. And if it was actually things that we were currently working on, you know, specific goals, whatever it was that we were trying to go ahead and do. And then we go ahead and we were basically using it as a formative assessment versus this kind of high stakes one-time test, that then we could have a different conversation. But unfortunately, that is not where we're at. And it's, I could change one thing, it would definitely be that.
So let me ask you this. What do we do? What as teachers, as coaches, what do we do about it? Because it doesn't feel like we're pushing towards a real change right now. We might be in isolated pockets of classrooms, but I don't know that on a systemic level, we're actually pushing towards change.
Yeah. I do talk about this. I mean, obviously I talk about it within my own school, but I also talk about it on the podcast sometimes. And definitely when I'm at conferences, I just think that we as educators need to speak up about all of the amazing things that are happening within our schools. And then also be very frank about the things that are causing distress in our students and that are basically holding us back from being an optimal education system. And this is the number one thing. So speaking out against it, basically to our communities, number one, but then also not being afraid of going ahead and speaking to our legislators, because these are the people that are basically allowing for this to continue to take place. So it's been set up now that this is the way that we go ahead and assess our students, even if it's completely wrong. And I've seen some states actually make some great progress towards just throwing away the previous system of standardized testing. Like in New Mexico, a new governor came in and she said, the first thing that I'm doing is we're not going to do this high stakes testing anymore. We're going to figure out as educators, as an education community, what is the best way to assess our students? And they're finding ways of being able to do that. If you gather all of our collected energy and mental abilities together as educators, man, we can come up with some amazing solutions. I think in the end, it would go against the, you know, what is currently the mold. And I think a lot of the current mold takes place because of it's a big moneymaker. And a lot of people don't want to talk about that standardized testing through K-12 and then also at the college level is a big business, and it's connected to big book companies. And if we took that away, that takes away some of their ability to be able to go ahead and continue to make money off of these things. So we need to just call that out and say, hey, this is not the path forward. Let's change it. And let's find better ways of being able to do that.
Yeah, I definitely agree wholeheartedly about speaking up and speaking honestly, because, and not just about, you know, the good things. We need to talk about the good things for sure. But I think, yes, I'm with you that we shouldn't be avoiding the issues. And if my podcast stands for one thing, it's that question of what is the big issue we're not addressing? Because I feel like so often in education, it's all of our problems are the elephant in the room, because we don't want to, like, people already don't like us because we have summers off and we can't complain about what we're doing. You know, it's like,
absolutely.
And we cannot let that fear silence us. Their kids are just, it's too important. We can't be silenced when we need to speak up about some of these issues.
Absolutely, man. Totally agree with you. And just look at your kids' faces, your students' faces, you know, your own kids, if you have them too. I just look at my son and I'm like, what I don't want you to lose, and of course, I'd never tell him this to his face, but what I don't want him to lose is just his passion for learning. Mm-hmm. I mean, that he has that in him, and so do our kids. All of our students do. We don't want to go ahead and suck that out of their systems because we decide, you know, because we're compelled to do these systems that are already in place, including this whole thing about these high stakes standardized testing. Yeah,
completely. And I would point my audience, and I can't remember if it was your podcast or another one. It might have been yours, but the you talked about the money making aspects of it, and I would point my audience to the John Oliver piece he did a few years ago on the standardized testing. That is just the best breakdown ever of how completely and utterly flawed this whole thing is. That still, like 3 years later, it's probably the best piece that covers this whatsoever. So definitely worth the watch.
For sure. Yes, so. Yes. I think Mike has mentioned that one several times too.
Yeah,
yes.
It's a great piece. It really gives you an interesting and honestly terrifying look at some of the background stuff that's going on in education right now. man, we're rocking and rolling. You know, I don't think there's many people that would argue with you in education and say, nah, testing's fine. I like standardized testing. It's going great. So not exactly a hot take, but I think you're right. I think you're onto something.
Yeah.
So I like it.
Awesome.
Huh. Cool. Let's roll into my second one. Let's go to my second question. And I'm actually really intrigued by this now that you're, you know, over a year through being a coach and not just out of the classroom with that fresh vision. What is something that you're doing that you wish all educators would do?
Ooh, that's a really good one. Well, I guess I could talk about it in the frame of the discussion that we've been having here for the last few weeks, not only on the podcast, but also at my school. But basically, the concept of breaking out of our little rooms, our, you know, people call it living in your silos, you know, that kind of thing, and really stepping out beyond that and using social media as the platform to be able to connect with other educators. And it's super scary. And some people actually, you know, just don't want to do it for a variety of different reasons, especially on the social media type of platform. But I'm telling you right now that I was a teacher for 13 years that taught as the only world language teacher in a classroom. And when you are that one isolated teacher, you can definitely feel that you don't have anyone to bounce ideas off of. You don't have the feedback that you need, both you know, positive and critical feedback that you need to be able to grow. And without that, you're limiting yourself as far as being able to go ahead and step beyond where you're at. And I think one of the amazing things, and actually one of the things that lifts me up every single day is this concept of having a professional learning network with many, many people, thousands of people that some of them I've actually met in real life and some of them I have not. But you know what? It doesn't matter. They're there to help me to become a better whatever I am. So in this case, an instructional coach, but when I was teaching, to become a better Spanish teacher. So I would say the number one thing that I wish everybody was doing was basically connecting with each other and stepping beyond their classroom walls and saying, hey, I'm going to open up my classroom. I'm going to make myself vulnerable, you know, because we do make ourselves vulnerable then, saying, here's what I do. What do you think? You know, and a lot of times we don't want to tell anybody anything. We have a big fear, which is, I totally get it. I totally get that fear because people don't want to lose their jobs. They don't want to expose themselves or whatever it might be. But in order for the profession to truly grow and for all of us to continue to take strides forward, that is the biggest thing that I think that if we all did that, or if the majority of us did that, it wouldn't be so scary anymore, number one. And number two, it would be a great space for all of us to continue to move forward, have these great discussions. And we're not always going to agree, but I guarantee we will all end up growing. And we also, I think a lot of more people would stay in the teaching profession because I think a lot of people leave. And one of the things that they cite is basically they feel isolated. They feel like they're alone. They can't find that connection within their school, their specific building school. And so this is a way to be able to reach beyond the walls of the school and then be able to still have that connection in our profession. And I know that this happens in all kinds of other professions. It just needs to really become part of the teaching profession. Yes.
I have like 15 ways I want to take that. And I'm trying to decide which one I want to go with. You know, that very end there, you made a comment about how this happens in all these other professions. And interestingly enough, as you were talking, I was thinking about asking, is it fair that we're asking teachers to spend even more of their time on the education profession in order to be a better educators, when in other professions you would be paid to go to development and professional development and things of that nature? But then, as you said, other people, you know, there are networking mixers and things like that, that professionals, yes, working professionals in business and industry go to all the time, now that I'm thinking about it. And you're right, it's not uncommon to exist outside of that space. It's not just education that should be doing this. So you answered my question without even meaning to, I think, before I even asked it. So you're on it. You know, it's just, you mentioned that fear. What would you say to someone who is worried or feels that their district is not supportive of teachers having a public presence?
That's a really scary one too. You're right. Cause I don't want to be that person that ends up telling you, you need to just do this no matter what. And then they end up losing their job. You do have to tread lightly. It's just like with standardized testing, me speaking out against it at certain districts, that would not be tolerated. You know, it wouldn't be something that you could just say out loud. It was something that you might say in private, but you might not be able to say it out, and especially not in a public forum like this. So you do have to tread lightly, but I would say speak to your admin and really bring them solid examples of what really happens in this kind of social media presence when you do have that, and show them that the type of growth that can happen and that has happened with so many different people because of this kind of presence there too. And I, again, I don't want to force anybody to do that. And I think you're right though. You're on the right track of, should we put this on educators as something on top of what all the things that they already do, you know, and then now you're still continuing basically to grow as a professional. And I would say, yes, we should, but we should also compensate that. You know, in other professions, you're compensated enough and well enough that the demands are, I think, are high for those types of things to continue to grow in your profession, being a medical professional or a lawyer, whatever it might be. You're going to continue to grow in your profession. Same thing with teaching, except we do it a lot of the time. We do it on our own time. And a lot of times, I mean, most of us, we end up paying for our own growth. You know, we pay out of our own pockets, mm-hmm, to go to conferences. We pay out of our own pockets to go to a university to be able to get our master's degree or our doctoral degrees, or just to continue to go ahead and grow in the profession, which is just disgusting if you compare it to other professions, which the equity between the profession is not even close to being there. We definitely are kind of like lowest on the totem pole, if you could even have us on the totem pole of professions. So we definitely need to rise up, you know, but I think when you go out there and connect in this way that I'm talking about with other professionals, you will feel the power of that, basically saying, I've got something here. And when I deliver stuff to my students and when the things that I'm doing in my class, I know are the right things. It's things that are effective. And I have kind of this community that backs me, you know, on great days and on days that maybe they aren't so great. Yeah. So I kind of went off a million tangents there. Sorry.
No, I'm with you. And you know, the other thing you touched on is in other professions, it's incentivized, it's paid for in to go to these kinds of events and things of that nature, which is totally true. But there's also an investment component in other industries.
Yes.
In other industries, I may do it out of my own pocket, but it's because it can lead to a promotion or a raise, or I can use it on my next evaluation or whatever.
Absolutely.
In education, how many of us actually get to even bargain for our own pay?
No.
I mean, we're set pay and that's it. We don't have any choices. And how, I mean, I've never got a raise because I went to ISTE or no. I went to an ed camp, or like, I've never got a bonus for any of that stuff. I've done it on my own time.
Yes.
And you know, there's no connection to financial gain. And there is that, you know, it kind of goes back to that martyr problem of education, which is I do it for my students, not for myself, not for the pay, not for the things. And, you know, we do it because it's best for kids, and which is great. And that's a noble calling and all those other things. But at some point, you do got to worry about yourself and your actual kids.
For sure.
You know,
you got to get paid. And that's a big shift that I've made in my own thinking as a, as a person who is just basically venturing outside of public education too, and just basically saying, okay, so there are other means of making money. I used to look down on people that were doing that, and then now I'm doing it myself, and I'm like, okay, well, this is, I can see why people are doing this. It's because we have an opportunity, number one, to do it, but number two, why would you not seek out a way to be able to have more income being able to be brought into your family?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, actually, I was going to bring this up because I found this a fascinating discussion on your podcast about your sort of change of position on TPT and
yes.
and just in general, which interestingly enough, you were talking about the Edupreneur by Dr. Will, and yes. I had him on the show a month ago, right before it released. I had him on talking about that. He's been on the show before that too, but I love Dr. Will. He's a great dude, and when I heard he was making that documentary, I could not wait. It was so good, and then to hear you guys talk about it, I thought was really cool. So, yes. but you know, like you said, there is that change of mindset. There is something about it, even for those of us that are doing podcasts and on social media and out doing things beyond the classroom, there's still a negative stigma in making money in education, right? Like, why? That doesn't make sense. It makes no sense to be upset about making money. It's yes, ridiculous.
It is a big stigma, and it's tough to take. I mean, it's and. My biggest thing was I didn't want to limit the resources that would go out to, this is the reason why I was against TPT in general, is I wanted to make sure that we could all grow together, and I didn't want to limit my ability to affect another Spanish teacher with an amazing lesson that I had because they didn't have, you know, the $10 I had on that lesson or whatever it might be. On the other hand, I watched Dr. Will's Edupreneur video, the DVD, and I'm just completely blown away by the time, effort, skills, and just amazingness that these people have put in basically into the education profession and helped us all grow. And they should be compensated for those things. And so I was more than willing to, you know, eat my own words there and go like, yeah, I was actually wrong. This whole stigma against basically making money, I was definitely part of that. And so it's kind of takes, you know, you take a step back and go, gosh, I'm wrong. And this is a legitimate way of being able to monetize your skills, whatever those skills actually might be.
Yeah. Totally. Wow. We're everywhere. We're in all the topics. We're jumping around. We've gone from standardized testing to TPT yes. and the Edupreneur and talking about it. Social media. We're in all of the places right now. I like it. I love it. Man, what a good chat. All right. I got one more. Okay. I got one more question for you.
Sounds good.
And my last question for all my guests is a little more personal.
Okay.
Who is the greatest teacher you've ever had?
Oh, the greatest teacher I've ever had. Well, it's probably a tie. I'm gonna give you two answers. Number one, best teacher just in life, is definitely my mom. I talk about her a lot in my writing and when I give any types of speeches in public, because she's my mom is my total inspiration for everything that I do. She was an illegal immigrant coming into the United States. And she basically knew that she needed to do what needed to happen, even if it was illegal, to make a better life for herself. And it was a super big struggle. And just her life story and her what's happened throughout her life and where she is now, she's a total hero. And my biggest teacher as far as talk about perseverance and grit, I can never get to a moment in my life. I will never be at a moment in my life where I'll be like, well, you know, my mom is always going to be able to top anything that I'm going to go through, basically. So super big inspiration, super amazing to have her in my life. And my actual teacher that made a biggest impact on me is, and I talked about this actually on an episode of the podcast, because there was the teacher of the year, and I'm not going to be able to remember his name, Rodney Rogers, I think is his name. He the National Teacher of the Year is a teacher at a, an alternative school, alternative setting. Actually, it was in a, I think in a school, a detention center for youth. And so I was telling my story that basically as a youth, I was disenfranchised and I was a delinquent. I was basically a criminal. I got sent to an alternative school. I was disenfranchised with school and society in itself. And all I cared about was me and doing things that were bad and evil. And just luckily enough, we moved between my eighth grade year, and my ninth grade year to a different town. And we moved to New Mexico from El Paso, Texas to New Mexico. And I, that's where I met this teacher just by happenstance and a scheduling fluke. I didn't even sign up for the class. And I got pushed into a Spanish class. And I already knew how to speak Spanish. But I got put into this class and this teacher basically changed my life because he was one of the first people ever, especially in the teaching profession, that ever just basically told me that there was something special about me and that the gift that I had with the Spanish language, that I shouldn't take that for granted. And that I also shouldn't take for granted that I am Mexican-American, that I should be proud of that heritage and do something good with it. And I never had heard anyone ever say, speak in this kind of, kind of inspirational tone. And he basically was my mentor through my high school years and led me to, I took his AP courses and scored fives on both of the AP Spanish tests and then went to college for to be a Spanish teacher because of this guy, Mr. Wagner. And I mean, it just shows you though the impact that this one person, I mean, any one of us can make on the, on one or many of our kids' lives just by listening to them and then uplifting them, you know, lifting them up from where they were actually at. So that's my actual real teacher hero. And my life hero is my mom.
Well, yeah, and you have to imagine that he was telling more than just you that, right? Like, I mean, you have to imagine he had that impact on others as well.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you can never measure that sort of, that, that sort of impact that a human, a one person can have who truly just believes in the power of what they're doing.
Yes. And you're right. I mean, when you're sitting there as a teenager, as an egocentric person, whatever it might be, you're full of yourself. You don't see the impact that they're making on all of these other kids. And I'm sure that he absolutely was throughout his whole long teaching career.
Crazy.
Yes.
You know,
so now you got the personal Glenn Irvin story.
Yeah, I like it. No, I love it. You know, it's funny. I think that, I look at people who are change agents. You know, I look at someone like you who's a, who's an instructional coach and is out there running the podcast and doing these sort of innovative things and pushing for change in education on the whole. And you're someone who was disenfranchised with school in general, right? Like someone who didn't find value in what this is. And I think it's so rare for someone who didn't find value in the educational system as a kid to go into education because we didn't find value in it. So why would we do it? And I'm very much in the same boat. I didn't find a lot of value in education. And I think that makes it a lot easier for those of us that felt that way to say, no, no, all this is flawed. And it has been for a really long time versus most teachers who became teachers because they liked school, right? I mean, would you think that's would you say that's a fair, maybe that's an assumption, but is it a fair assumption from your perspective?
I think it's absolutely a fair assumption. A lot of teachers loved being students of whatever it was that they were, you know, compelled to go into, whether it was like math or they loved to work with young kids, or as a young kid they were had an amazing elementary school teacher and they're like, gosh, I want to be that. And so it's harder to see the flaws in the system, you're right, and it's harder to speak out especially against them. But like you just said from yourself, I am exactly the same way. I'm more than willing to speak out because I can see that there could be something better, that there will be something better if we are willing to go ahead and speak out against it and then make those changes come to life.
Yeah, it's always, you know, it's the path that lead us here and how important they are to what we're doing, you know, If it's not that side of it, the other side I'm thinking of, because when I got into education initially, I came through an alternative certification option. So I didn't go to school to become a teacher. And I came into the classroom really not having a clue what I was doing. And I just fell back on what I was taught and how I was taught.
Yes.
And it was a few years before I felt confident enough in my classroom in order to be able to say, you know what, maybe this isn't the best way to do things. And so I think if it's not, it's a confidence issue on so many, and it's a, I liked school, so why would we change it on some, but God, we got to do something, right? Like something, so we got to figure out that secret sauce for everybody.
Yeah. We got to get to that tipping point where the majority of us say, that's enough. There is a better way. Here's a path towards that better way. That's the other thing too, is a lot of people don't know, you know, we're pulled in so many different directions. And the school years go by, like you just said, even in, you know, in that first year, but just in general, they go by in this, in kind of a blur. And then the summer suddenly happens and we kind of reset and then we begin again, you know, in the fall, and it kind of begins that cycle again, you know, and you never get a chance to go, hold on a second. we need to do something here about what's happening, and we need to make an impactful change. And really, like I said, I think a lot of people are on that boat, like you were talking about, as far as the standardized testing or whatever it might be that we need to change. We need to talk to our legislators about that. And a lot of legislators are more than willing to listen to educators. The really good ones are, and they want to know, like, what is it that we need to do? What is it as a legislator do I need to do to make schools better and to make your lives better so that you reach more students, you know? And that's what the people that we need to be talking to. And if we can get enough of those people, you know, we will make big change.
Something you said there just really clicked with me, just the cyclical nature of a school year, you know, yes. that reset in the summer and then back into starting over, and then it flies by, and then your frustrations are all cyclical, and it, man, that does kind of, like, by nature, that would lock you in to being resistant to change on some level, or at least to making change harder, because like you said, it resets. You get that 2 month reset every time, and by the time you get back, it's just, all right, new kids, let's start over,
let's do this again.
Man, I never thought about that. That's cool. I like that.
Oh, that's awesome.
So we gotta break the cycle in order to make change happen. Like, I think that's an important thing to think about. Wow.
Cool. I'm going to write that down.
That's going in the show notes. I'm going to say that one out loud. That's getting committed. I like it, man. Glenn, this has been so much fun. I've had awesome time.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on. I loved it.
Yeah. I've had an awesome time. How can my audience get a hold of you if they would like to reach out and learn more?
For sure. I am on Twitter at Irv Spanish, IRV Spanish, all of one word. And then my email address, I always give it out because it's my own personal email address. It's just my name, Glenn Irvin, GLENIRVIN @gmail.com. And more than happy to reach out to me if you are a Spanish teacher or someone that's interested at, you know, in things that I'm interested in, which are things like gamification or game-based learning or even the podcast, whatever you actually might be interested in or just want to connect, reach out to me. I'm more than happy. And if I'm a big proponent of, if someone follows me on Twitter, I will definitely follow you back. And if I don't, please tell me, because I will feel guilty if I don't, because I want to make sure that we build an awesome community together.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, check out On Education Pod, because the On Education Podcast is just awesome. And links will definitely be in the show notes for that one to be able to check it out, because I highly recommend this show. It has become one of my favorite listens as they release them, and it's just definitely worth it. Check it out.
Thank you so much.
Even if you don't love video games, I'm sure you could still get a lot out of the show, but I do love video games, so I'm totally okay with it. although I don't know how I feel about you guys playing this community farm game all the time. I feel like you're putting way too many hours into this game. I'm not going to lie.
We did put too many hours in, and we both ended up retiring off of it for a while. Till this summer, we'll see what happens.
Then you reset the cycle, and your farm comes back up. There you go. That's how we're it back goes. Up again. Well, Glenn, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Glenn, thank you so much for joining me on the show. You really got me thinking, especially with your comments about the cyclical nature of the school year making change harder. In fact, after we recorded this episode, Glenn sent me a link to a blog post he wrote about that topic that is definitely worth the read. He does an awesome job of explaining the idea further and makes a pretty excellent gaming metaphor to boot.
You can find it at the link in the show notes, so just swipe on over and hit this link in the show notes. To connect with Glenn, you can find him on Twitter. He's at Irv Spanish. You can also email him directly at glennirvin@gmail.com. Also, definitely check out the On Education podcast, which is a truly wonderful show about technology and education, gaming, and just a lot of fun to listen to. You can find that show in iTunes by searching On Education or at the link in the show notes. If you have comments or questions about the show, you can always connect with me on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at Brad Schreffler. I love to hear from you guys there, and it's also a great place to connect if you'd like to be a guest on the show. Or the feedback page on my website that gives you additional options for feedback, and you can find that at bradschreffler.com/feedback. And I look forward to meeting some of you at ISTE on Sunday, June 23rd at 6 p.m. Until next week, think of ways to break the cycle of school so change can happen. Music for the Planning Period podcast is the song Vicious by Kevin MacLeod, used under Creative Commons. You can find him at incompetech.com. The Planning Period podcast is also a proud member of the VoiceEd Radio Network, a 24-hour radio network all about education all the time. VoiceEd Radio, your voice is right here.